Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Adam Gaffney. I'm a physician, pulmonary and critical care. I am an instructor at Harvard Medical School, and I'm active in the organization Physicians for a National Health Program.
All right. So, Adam, what the hell are the Republicans trying to do to us?
Well, if you look at this plan, I don't really consider it much of a health care plan, so much as a conduit of dollars from working class people to rich people. Because if you look at it, Sarah, it keeps a lot of the Affordable Care Act in place, but it denigrates it and it twists it and it corrupts it to the benefit of the very wealthy. Just from the big picture perspective, what are some of the things it's doing? Well, on the one hand, it is cutting programs. So there's a major cut to Medicaid. Over 10 years, we're talking about greater than $800 billion in Medicaid cuts. And that's about a quarter of federal spending. And that is going to throw millions of people off of Medicaid. And, as you know, Medicaid is a program for lower income people that covers a lot of Americans, more than 70 million. And so that's one thing. Second thing is it's going to sort of weaken the subsidies that people use to buy health plans on the marketplaces, the so-called Obamacare plans. And those are going to still be around. The private insurance industry will still be subsidized, but those subsidies are going to be worse, they're going to be more aggressive, and they're going to be less adequate for many folks. So that's one side of the ledger. On the other side of the ledger, there's just a huge redistribution of wealth upwards. Essentially, it gets rid of a variety of taxes that the Affordable Care Act put in place that are going to almost entirely benefit the very wealthy. So I'm just going to read to you a couple of numbers from the Congressional Budget Office's latest estimates. We're talking about $127 billion to people making over $200,000 through lower Medicare tax cuts. $145 billion over 10 years for the health insurance industry. $172 billion over 10 years for lowered capital gains for high-income earners. And that's just a few. So big picture, we're weakening the healthcare safety net. We're taking those dollars and we are funneling them upward.
And because, of course, cutting capital gains taxes is very related to health insurance, right?
They would argue that this is part of the Affordable Care Act and that they're simply repealing it. But functionally speaking, this is an upward redistribution of wealth.
Right. So this is the second time the Republicans finally managed to butter and squirt this thing through with one vote to spare. What happens next here?
Well, it goes to the Senate, of course, and it faces serious headwinds in the Senate. And many people are saying this. A lot of senators are very wary about these effects, particularly on Medicaid. There is much less room for error in the Senate. They can't lose, more than a couple of senators and still pass this through. So my gut feeling, and I'm not very good at political prognostication, so this is sort of worth what you're paying for it, is that they're going to pass something, but it is going to be a much more watered-down version of the House bill. And then the question will be, is the House willing to pass that? And I don't know. Don't forget that the version 1.0 of Trump Care was sunk mainly because of resistance from the hard right within the House. The House Freedom Caucus, they did not feel like the law went far enough. And that was a pretty ugly law. So, the question is how much can the Senate change this bill and still have it be passable in the House? And that remains to be seen.
Yeah, and there is a definite sense right now that a lot of the so-called moderates who wound up voting for this did so with the expectation that the Senate would change it anyway.
I mean, that's certainly the case. And I think the expectation and the hope that they would change it. I mean, I think that there is, you know, a realization on the part of many moderates in the House, so-called moderates, that this is an ugly, unpopular bill. I mean, the last poll I saw was the one that was being cited around the time of version 1.0. And if you recall, that showed 17% support for the Trump care. And so that is a dismal level of support. And, you know, part of that is because, you know, let's remember what Trump actually campaigned on. His health care promises were vague, but they weren't what he's doing now. You know, he said he wasn't going to cut Medicaid. He says he wasn't going to cut Medicare. And he basically promised more health care for everybody. So every time people sort of chuckle and say, oh, well, I can't wait to see the Trump voters, you know, get what they voted for. I mean, on the one hand, I think that's really nasty. And that's not sort of how we should be approaching politics. But on the other hand, you know, they, you know, and you can fault them for being poorly informed. But Trump did promise something different. He promised more health care, not less. And this is just less health care. I mean, it's really just a quantitative switch of health care spending. It's just less money going to the health care safety net and more money going to the pockets of high-income people and health care companies.
Yeah, and so I thought it would be interesting because we're talking about, again, this mess of a process of this thing trying to get through both houses and to the president, to talk a little bit about the process by which the Affordable Care Act itself came to be a thing, and that was after a summer of, you know, yelling town hall meetings from the Tea Party trying to stop Obamacare. And so the thing that ended up getting through... I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that process and sort of where the weak spots in that process were.
Well, I think if you want to look at the weak spots of that process, you have to go back to the beginning, which was a rejection from day one of single payer, of something more expansive. And so, you know, in that primary, the assumption was that among all the candidates, you know, in the 2008 primary, Democratic primary, there was already an assumption that single payer was not going to be an option, and basically all the candidates were opposed to it. So I think that they and Max Baucus certainly, you know, conceived of a very much middle of the road compromise bill from day one. So I think the biggest flaw in the Obamacare process was actually was before the summer of discontent, you know, and before that the Tea Party revolt, and really starting from the assumption that we had to do something much more narrow. You know, people talk about the sort of origins of the Affordable Care Act, and you know, some people say, oh, it's the Heritage Plan, which is true only really insofar as it incorporated the individual mandate. But it is true that the Affordable Care Act was largely modeled on an even older plan. It was sort of modeled on Nixon's plan, 1970s. Ted Kennedy in 1970 put something out there called the Health Security Act, which is basically a single payer plan. And Nixon proposed this, put up this counter proposal that included an employer mandate, included an expansion of a Medicaid-like program. And so in many ways, you know, the fatal flaw of Obamacare was its assumption from the beginning that we had to involve the private insurance industry as a key element within our healthcare system.
I think it's also worth talking about a little bit about the way that the politics around so-called Obamacare have played out, and you find that people either sort of don't know that what they have is the Affordable Care Act, or people were frustrated because of the jump from like being eligible for the Medicaid expansion to then suddenly having to pay out of pocket, even for subsidized care, things like that. So I wonder if you could talk about the way that sort of the construction of this bill made it easier to attack.
Right. Well, the construction of the bill was that it reinforced an existing fragmented system. It did not create a new public benefit. And so as soon as you do that, you are sacrificing popular support. If you look at a program like Medicare, which is a universal benefit that you get when you turn 65, obviously, it is extraordinarily popular because people know what they're getting. Under Obamacare, it's very unclear. Most people are sort of unsure of how they are affected by the law. It doesn't create social solidarity in the same way that a universal public program does. Yes, I mean, I think that, you know, part of the problem with Obamacare is that everything, is that it fragments sort of society. Now, I think that the Medicaid expansion was good. I think it helped a large number of people. But as you say, many people in the middle sort of ground are still being squeezed. Deductibles, Sarah, have been rising dramatically in recent years. That's not the fault of Obamacare. It preceded Obamacare, but Obamacare has been blamed for it. Yeah. Co-payments, deductibles, co-insurance are rising. People are, you know, finding that even they, although they are insured, they're unable to afford going to the physician or getting a prescription filled. And that is a major problem, and I think that is feeding into a lot of discontent around this law. And so I think that Obamacare has not created the social support necessary for its own propagation as a result of those inherent weaknesses.
Yeah. And now that said, one of the interesting things that it did do was at least reinforce the idea that the government should do something about your healthcare problems. And so then we do see people, you know, again, reacting to the Republican plan to take away what healthcare people do have with this intense anger.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's amazing and a lot of people have said this, but there's been a whole shift, I think, in the way we think about healthcare towards at least an implicit recognition of healthcare as a right. I mean, Charles Krauthammer sort of said this on Fox the other day, you know, conservative columnist, obviously. And he's, you know, as he said, and I agree, even the conservatives are having to defend their healthcare plan with this sort of implicit argument that this is, that everybody deserves coverage.
Yeah.
And in a way, that suggests that the battle in the discursive realm is actually already being won. People are increasingly believe that healthcare should be a right. The fact that, you know, when the Congressional Budget Office released its estimates of Trump Care and said that 24 million people will be uninsured, that was shocking. That, you know, was terrible for the bill's popularity. Nobody found a way, nobody could defend that. And in a real free market sense, that should be fine. You know, 24 million people, quote unquote, elect to not buy insurance. Well, who are we to say that's a problem? Nobody really thinks that way outside of like a very narrow spectrum of sort of zany and cold-hearted libertarians. So I agree. I think there's been an implicit progressive acceptance of the notion that the federal government or the government should ensure that everybody has access to health care. And that's one good thing that's certainly been happening.
So on that note, how do we stop this thing from proceeding through the Senate?
Well, I mean, I think that we have to stop it. Even if those of us who believe that we need to go well beyond the Affordable Care Act should absolutely recognize the harm that this would do, the deaths that it would cause. You know, a lot of people have put out estimates of potential deaths that could result in from something like this. You know, I threw out a number in my recent Guardian piece of around 24,000 people a year, or 24 million people lose their health insurance. So lives are on the line. Suffering will increase. So we have to stop it. I think that it's an all hands on deck approach. I think every senator has to be picketed, targeted. I think that they should know that if they vote for this, that they are going to face the full wrath of the citizenry. You know, I think the more protests, the more activism around this in the very short term, the better. It's obviously going to play out one way or the other very soon. This isn't gonna, the Trump care battle is a short term fight. In that if they don't get this through soon, and they need to in order to use reconciliation to get it passed, it's dead.
Yeah. And explain reconciliation. We touched on that, I guess, talking about the ACA, but for people who don't understand how that process works.
Right. So, you know, in general, a filibuster in the Senate means that you need to have 60 votes to overcome it. There's going to be no Democrats going along with the health care bill, the Trump care, as far as we know. In order to get around the 60 votes requirement, there is a provision of reconciliation that allows bills that have a predominantly budgetary impact to be passed with a simple majority. And so in order, but that has to be done, sort of, there's a timeline for that. And so it has to be done relatively soon. There's actually some question whether some provisions in the House bill would even be allowed to be passed through reconciliation. There's something called the Byrd Rule that sort of describes what sorts of things are allowed to be included. So we don't even know if the House bill in its current form could actually be passed through reconciliation. But regardless, they're going to need to pass, if they want to pass anything, it's going to have to be through reconciliation, because unless they really come to the center in some way, they're not going to get enough Democratic senators to go along, or any Democratic senators to come along to hit 60 votes.
So, and while we're making their lives miserable, you've been part of the fight for single payer for quite a long time now. Talk about where you think that fight is and why it's important to keep it up, even as we're trying to stop the healthcare apocalypse here.
It's critical because the status quo is very unjust. I mean, you know, think of it this way. Trump Care is going to increase the number of uninsured by 24 million. But in 2016, according to the National Health Interview Survey, there was still 28 million people uninsured today. And then even more people than that who are underinsured, who are, again, having high copayments, high deductibles, unable to go to the doctor, unable to fill prescriptions. So the status quo is bad. But as long as that's the case, we're going to keep the door open to right-wing attack. Always be the right-wing economic populist who's going to say they're going to, you know, like Trump, who's going to make healthcare better. That we're opening the door to that if we don't do something about it. So it's critical that we keep the fight going for a better tomorrow, for a better future of healthcare, and not just rear guard defensive battles of keeping things they are where they are. Because the reality is, Sarah, is that people are not happy with the way things are today. It's not good enough. So now, counter argument might be, well, is this, you know, what is the likelihood? Are we ever going to get single payer passed under this current government? And no, we're not. But we could under the next government. And so this is the time when we coalesce. This is the time when we put together our arguments, when we put together our coalitions, when we begin to turn senators and representatives to single payer, so that when the political tide turns, we can see this happen. And we need the grassroots armies in place now to do that.
Yeah. Excellent. And so how can people be part of those grassroots armies? Where can they get involved with healthcare organizing?
Right. Well, there's so many different organizations out there that are doing single payer work. I mean, you know, my organization is Physicians for National Health Program. It's sort of centered around medical professionals, although we certainly have other members as well. There's Healthcare Now. There's you know, various labor organizations are very involved in this. National Nurses United, which is the largest nurses union in the country, is very much behind single payer. So, you know, I think it depends on where you are and kind of what sort of work you want to do, and if you want to get involved in a group that's maybe affiliated with your profession or not. And so I think that there's a host of groups out there. There's something called the Coalition for Guaranteed Healthcare. That's a coalition of different groups. You can go to their website and see some of those groups. But I mean, there's lots of activism on this issue. And I think, yet from a larger perspective, healthcare activism can really be a critical pillar of the left moving forward. I think it's an issue that does bring people together. I think it's an issue that has resonance with the general population. A Gallup poll from last year finds 58% support among the general public for single payer. So I think this is a good cause that can help galvanize energy on the left. Obviously, there's many other campaigns we need to be fighting and working towards. I'm not suggesting this be the, you know, primary, but I think it can be a galvanizing movement and campaign on the broader left struggle.
Excellent. And how can people keep up with you and your work?
Some other people, I am on Twitter, A.W. Gaffney, and I have a website, theprogressivephysician.net. I'd also send people to my organization's website, which is pnhp.org. It has some great resources on single payer, on the policy issues behind it, so that we can, you know, really mount our most effective arguments. Those sorts of resources can be very helpful for that.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.